This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. We have a powerful and, I think, unusually important Dreamland today about real magic, and with an expert, which you shall learn about in a moment. Also, in Whitley's room, in the subscriber area, there is a discussion of something I think that is quite extraordinary that I have learned recently about Anne, my ongoing relationship with her, and in general about relationship with those who have moved on into non-material life. So don't miss any of this, especially subscribers. Do listen to the Whitley's Room piece. It's a really unusual and I think a remarkable discovery. So in the third half hour of this show, I ask our guest, who's Dean Radin, by the way, something about hybrids and receive the single most remarkable answer to that question I have ever heard. It's going to really, really open your mind into a new level of understanding and new questions, but really new understanding. One of the great masters of some kind of science is back with us today. He was last on Dreamland on our year-end special in 2017. So it's been a while since we have had Dean Radin with us, and we're going to have a good long discussion with him today. He is the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences and associated distinguished professor of integral and transpersonal psychology at the California Institute of Integral Studies. He is the author of a number of books. We have had him on for Entangled Minds. He's the author of The Conscious Universe also, and Supernormal. And we're going to be talking about this. But we are going to mostly be talking about a book that is most recently out, Real Magic, Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science, and a Guide to the Secret Power of the Universe, described by Brian Josephson as a convincing case for the reality and significance of magic. And we're using that word. And Dean is going to tell us just exactly why. If you don't know who Brian Josephson is, he happens to be a Nobel laureate in physics. Another Nobel laureate in physics, Carrie Mullis, also gave the book a beautiful review. And Carrie and I were good friends, and he's passed on now and greatly missed. Dean, welcome to Dreamland.
Thanks very much.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to have you with us, and I would thank you again for taking the time. I'd like to begin by talking a little bit about IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which you've been involved with for so long and play such an important role in. Can you tell us a little bit about its mission and how to learn more about the wonderful programs that you can so easily get involved in?
Sure. So the Institute of Noetic Sciences was founded in 1973, so we're coming up onto our 50th anniversary in a few years. It was founded by the Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell as a result of an experience that he had in the space capsule coming back to the Earth from the Moon. He had a mystical experience, full-blown feeling of unity with everything. And as an MIT-trained scientist and naval officer and astronaut, this was a little bit unexpected to have a mystical experience in space. So when he came back to Earth, he was determined to get to the bottom of what a mystical experience is, given the rest of what we know about the universe from science. And so the word noetic was selected as a term meaning deep knowing through intuition, but knowing of a peculiar kind where you have certainty that your intuition is correct. This was a word that William James defined way back when. So what we study is the nature of consciousness. One of the original mission phrases was, we study the frontiers of consciousness, meaning, what is it? What's it good for? What are its capacities? Is it useful to know more about consciousness for our health and well-being? Those are the kinds of things that we've studied over many years, and we continue to do that. We have a in-house science program, six scientists on our team with different disciplines, all coming from traditional backgrounds, and we're all interested in these kinds of questions, all revolving around the nature of consciousness and what it's good for, essentially.
I might mention, folks, that Edgar Mitchell and I had a long relationship, and there is a wonderful interview, if you're a subscriber, with him from 2008 on Dreamland, where he talks extensively about the Roswell incident and about the fact that he grew up in Roswell, New Mexico, strangely enough. Mm-hmm. I can very well remember a time when Ann and I and John Mack and he were all together at a place in a house in South Carolina, I believe, spending a weekend with some wealthy people, talking about what it all meant to us. And Edgar described that experience coming back from the moon and what it did to him. And I said to him, you know, you can't actually put that into words, can you? He said, no, that's why I founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Mm-hmm. And, well, anyway, Dean, it is a great privilege to have you with us. And I want to move on now, though, getting deeper into the subject itself. When I say subject, you and I both know we cannot finish this. We couldn't finish this in a month or a year. But what about the meaning of the word magic as it has evolved in your mind over the years? You started out with quite a limited definition of that word, but what happened?
Well, magic in the current vernacular is Harry Potter, or if not Harry Potter, it's Harry Houdini. So it's stage magic, fictional magic, and used as a superlative, like magic shampoo, which means that it's amazing in some way. Of course, the original meaning of magic was all the way back into Persian. Basically, he's talking about wisdom, magi, magus. But magic, what I'm talking about then is, the way I put it is by analogy, that magic is to the esoteric traditions as technology today is to the scientific traditions. In other words, we always live within a worldview that is our way of thinking about the nature of reality. So there's a scientific worldview, and our technologies, all of our fancy computers and electronics and all the rest of it, were developed as a practice, as an application of the scientific worldview. Whereas magic was an application of the worldview that we today would call the esoteric traditions. So by that, I mean everything from Hermeticism to the Kabbalah to you name it. These are traditions that go as far back as human history goes, all the way back to shamanism. In more modern era, we see it encapsulated in things like the Rosicrucian texts and theosophy and so on. And all of them basically say that the world is created out of consciousness. It's what a philosopher would call idealism. That's the esoteric traditions. So magic is an application of that concept, that the world is created out of and sustained out of consciousness. That's what I mean by magic, at least as I talk about it in my book, Real Magic.
So essentially, I think it would be fair to say that you're talking about lost wisdom and something that once had significance in our world. You know, I've been writing a book about Jesus, and as a part of this, I have
revisited the miracles, because we are divided into two groups now in our world. One group says, it all happened, it's literally true. The other group says, none of it happened at all.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not true, actually. Some of it probably did happen. And I'm not going to segue into that area, but what I am interested in is, for example, in the chapter of your new book, in the chapter called Practice of Magic, you say that attention, the essence of it boils down to two ordinary mental skills, attention and intention. And what's so fascinating about this is, to me, it was so fascinating when I read it, was that that is a very succinct way of saying why some of the miracles actually happened and worked, probably happened, and if they did happen, probably worked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But can you tell us a little bit about the kind of intention that is necessary and the kind what the practice is about for someone who's really doing this and not playing parlor games?
Right. So the meaning of attention in particular in the magical traditions is a state of awareness called Gnostic, and starting with a G, G-N, Gnostic. So the Gnostic state in a yogic perspective, or from an Eastern perspective, would be called samadhi. And these are mystical states that typically through disciplined meditation or through ritual or in some cases certain psychedelic drugs, you get into a state which is very similar to what Edgar had experienced as a mystical state. You go into a state where there is the distinction between you and the rest of the universe begins to dissolve. As well, the distinction between now and then, and you and me, all of that begins to dissolve in a way where it does become ineffable. If you talk to somebody who has a mystical experience and say, well, tell me what that was like, they will use words, but it's not the nature of the experience. The experience is beyond language. But nevertheless, that's the state that magicians or yogis will talk about, where magical things begin to happen. So in a previous book that I wrote about the Eastern esoteric traditions, a yogi would get into this state of samadhi, and then they would gain the ability of clairvoyance and precognition and a whole bunch of other things, not so much because they are striving to get that, but simply as a side effect of being in this state of samadhi. In the magical traditions, which is not quite, but more towards Western culture, people would also do meditation or the equivalent, and they also develop rituals and that sort of thing. But the goal was the same, that in that state, you find that these kinds of abilities start to arise. So that's what both the attention part and the intention part come about. The attention is all about the nature of perception. What can you attend to? So in the right frame of mind, the past, present, and future are all laid out in front of you. There you can perceive all of it at the same time. So we talk about words like precognition and clairvoyance from a psychic perspective, but that's basically what we're talking about, perception through space and time. The intention part is more to do with the way that magic is portrayed in fiction, which is about making things happen in the world, changing destiny, forcing things with your mind. That is a part of the magical tradition. It's only a piece of it, but that is through directed intention. You want something to happen, and it happens, or at least the probability of it happening is a little bit more than it would have been without your intention. So that's what basically all of magical practices are about. Getting into the right frame of mind, being able to perceive beyond the limitations of space and time, and be able to intend in a way that will probably not force is the wrong word to use, but I would say, nudge in a probabilistic sense. It pushes the world around, pushes the probabilities of the world around in such a way as to favor the outcome that you wish to have.
Free Dreamlanders, when we get back, we're going to be talking to Dean about a couple of experiences that I think relate to just what he's been describing. We'll be right back. There was an incredible UFO wave going on back in 2007. Forgotten all about it? Well, we haven't on unknowncountry.com, and you can still explore it with one of the leading experts who was involved personally, Brian Vike. Listen to this.
A good friend of mine, he's in the UK, believe it or not, and of course I'm in Canada, and between the two of us, just two of us, we pulled in. Now, this is going to be a rough one. I think I stopped it at 434 reported sightings for Canada alone in 2007.
This is an excerpt from one of literally more than 1,000 different episodes of our various podcasts on unknowncountry.com. But how do you access them? We have a powerful search engine that enables you to access them by subject. But now also, when you go to the podcast drop-down menu, you will see at the bottom, Podcast Archive. This takes you to lists of all of our podcasts organized by year. And you can click on any year and browse through everything that's in that year for that podcast. This is a huge website, and we work more every day to make it accessible. For example, subscribers can now listen to the subscriber version of Dreamland on an app. There are a number of apps out there that will accommodate this, and subscribers will find more information about it in the subscriber section of unknowncountry.com on the Dreamland page.
There are hundreds of charitable organizations in the world, but you have to have a sharp eye to be sure your money is going to where it's needed and not into the pockets of overpaid administrators. That's why Whitley Strieber and UnknownCountry.com support the Mercy Corps. It's non-sectarian, it's lean and efficient, and it goes everywhere on earth that people are in need. When you contribute, you can be sure that most of your dollar goes right to the homeless, the starving, and the desperate. Go to Unknown Country and click on the Mercy Corps Foundation ad on the left side of your homepage. A $10 gift can put food on a child's plate and shoes on his feet. Unknown Country and Whitley Strieber receive no compensation from the Mercy Corps.
As always, Dreamland's theme music is The O of Pleasure from Ray Lynch's beautiful album, Deep Breakfast, available at raylynch.com. We're talking to Dean Radin. His book, Real Magic, Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science, and a Guide to the Secret Power of the Universe. He's also the best-selling author of Supernormal, and there's an awful lot of really grounded science-based wisdom in Dean's work. And if you want the kind of empowerment that I know everybody who listens to this show is looking for, as I am, Dean is a very good place to go to get it. As far as websites are concerned, the place to go is noetic.org, and you can engage with them very easily. There's loads of online conferences and stuff to do, and it's not terribly expensive either. I mean, it's very accessible. And some true experts are there. So definitely do that. Now, Dean, I would like to describe a couple of personal experiences to you. One happened about 3 years ago, and the other one, oddly enough, happened night before last. 3 years ago, I was in a meeting in a person's house with about 10 or 12 people, and it was a fairly formal meeting. But it was still in a home, and there were some candles about, and there was a cat who jumped up onto a shelf on which there was a lit candle. And I noticed that she waved her tail above the candle, and I thought to myself, oh my goodness, she's going to catch on fire. Nobody knows this. I have to put out that candle. And I could feel somewhere in my chest something opened, I would say. And I looked at the candle, and the candle went out immediately. And one of the guests said to me, "My God, what did you do?" Because he had seen, I had said something to him just a moment before about the candle. And I said, "Don't tell anybody." I didn't know what else to say. But I could feel that I could do it, is the point, and I did it. Now, 2 nights ago, I was meditating at 11 o'clock, as I do every night, and I was worried about the door, because I had only the lock and the handle on, and I was reminding myself, I was in a very deep meditative state, and I reminded myself to lock the door. And I heard some clicking, and I thought, "Oh my goodness, is there somebody out there trying the door?" Because somebody's been trying doors in our neighborhood. And then I got up to lock the door, and the door was locked. The clicking had been the locking of the door. And it can't be done from the outside. This is a deadbolt on the inside, and another type of lock as well. They don't even communicate with the outside. So, let's talk a little bit about that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's magic.
Exactly, so it's not magic. The word magic has been disempowered by illusionists. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, by fiction.
By fiction. Yeah.
Yeah. So. The what we're talking about here then is, what are the limits of intentional influence of the world? So first of all, if you're certainly coming out of a meditative state or being in a meditative state, you're a lot closer to that state of gnosis that the magicians are trying to achieve. And you've been meditating a very long time. So whether you call it gnosis or samadhi, you're probably pretty close to that or even in it. Well, that's the state where things like intentions, even relatively subtle intentions, will begin to influence the world at large. And, of course, this is not something that a casual whim in an ordinary state of mind will do very much. It takes disciplined practice, probably some talent, probably some experiences that are transformative and change your worldview, in order to get into and sustain that state. So you may very well have created what amounts to a macroscopic psychokinetic effect. Your intention got turned into action. When we try to study these things in the laboratory, it's not so easy.
No, I wouldn't think so. Tell us what are the problems and what you've achieved.
Well, so first of all, the need to do something is very difficult to devise in a laboratory context, right? You, in the case of closing the lock, you had a real need. This is something that needed to happen right now, and you were in the right frame of mind, and it all came together. In a laboratory, if we tried to create a context that was similar to that, it's possible, but it's very difficult, and even more difficult to get somebody in the right frame of mind in a laboratory context to do a psychokinetic event on demand under the terms that we want to see it, and by the way, do it right now. So when you add up all of the constraints of what we do in the lab, we do see effects, mostly evaluated statistically, but the effects overall are pretty strong. I mean, statistically strong. We can see the effects. So this is why we have high confidence that some psychokinetic effects are real, but something like turning a key in a lock or a deadbolt, we basically never see something of that magnitude. I'm talking about a macroscopic effect,
right,
in the laboratory.
Yeah, I can see why you wouldn't, but of course I am. In a permanent meditative state. I don't want to talk about it very much, but yes, I am after spending the good part of my life doing this. But the thing that sticks out here is the use of your use of the word need, because mm-hmm. that I was very concerned about that little cat, because it could have happened so quickly, and if her fur on her tail had caught fire, she would have right. died. She would have burst into flames and died.
Yeah.
I was extremely concerned about her. And in the case of the door, once again, I felt intense need.
Mm-hmm.
So that right. need – now, here's what I want to know. Can that need be – and this gets back a little bit to your answer. But if a magician knows how to do these things, how does he engage that need? Say he's got something or she's got something in her life that she really needs to have happen, and she knows this technique. How does she engage the technique?
Well, that's a good question. In some respects, the need itself, in some cases, may be enough, even without a special state of mind. Because when you're in an extreme case of need, it's not an ordinary state of awareness to begin with. You're already transcending the everyday world when you have extreme need. On the other hand, if you want to increase the probability of the need manifesting, then it helps a lot to be able to be into that meditative or Gnostic state. So what do they do in it? Well, the instructions actually come from the yogic traditions. In the yogic tradition, you become one with the thing that you are attending to. So if you, in a yogi, for example, in traditional yoga, if you wish to levitate, you meditate or you contemplate the idea of being the air or being gravity. And once you gain a unity with that concept, the distinction between you and the concept disappears. So you become gravity or you become the air. And as air, you're light and you can lift. If you want to become extremely heavy, you contemplate the idea of an elephant. You become an elephant, at least symbolically, and you gain the properties of an elephant and you become extremely heavy, and so on. So this is one of the strange things that happens in the state of samadhi or Gnostic state, where you and the object are no longer separate, and now you're sharing properties, including properties of super strength and invisibility and levitation and lots of very dramatic things that show up in movies, but not so often in the real world. But you also gain things like if you wish to have telepathy with your buddy, then you contemplate your buddy and become one with that person, and now you'd have perfect telepathic rapport with
yeah,
them.
I used to do that with Anne and piss her off.
Yeah. That's the technique. You become one with the thing that you wish to perceive or influence.
Yeah, she would say, "You're reading my mind." And I said, "No, no, I'm not." She said, "Yes, you are. I can feel it and go away."
Yeah. And she was right in the sense that you're not actually reading her mind. You are her mind.
Yeah, well, I didn't ever think of that, thank God. That would have really annoyed her.
That would have freaked both of you out, because then it's not only that you would know her thoughts, you would know deeper than her thoughts. You would know her mind in a way that she may not know it as well herself. And this is one of the things that sometimes freaks out people when they meet a very talented psychic. But the psychic will not only be able to pick up approximately what you're thinking, maybe not the exact words, but the intent of the words, they'll also be able to pick up things in your unconscious. And, of course, that's one of the values of going to a psychic, that they can tell you more about yourself than you already know. But that's what happens when one mind becomes or merges into another mind.
That's really very interesting, because that could become a discipline for me. I've never thought of it that way, but I could do that. I know that I could.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, Dean, you know, you're a fascinating guy. You're such an you have such a diffident delivery, but you're so empowering. I mean, you're empowering me right now, and I know that a lot of my listeners are like me. they have this stuff in their lives. Mm-hmm. And you're empowering them too by this very straightforward way of looking at this. I'm so glad we're doing this show. Okay. Now let's go on to, I want to talk about some specifics. You mentioned, levitation, and I think that let's start with Daniel Douglas Home, who mm-hmm. you talk about, in your book. And we're going to go back to Joseph of Cupertino too, but, let's start with Home.
Okay, so Home was popular during the heyday of spiritualism, late 1800s. He, unlike most mediums today, he was a physical medium. Mediums today are mostly mental mediums. In other words, they do things with their mind. They interact with spirits, they say. But a physical medium was able to do large-scale, in-your-face, macroscopic psychokinetic effects that were attributed to spirits. And so the thing about Home was that he, as many of these folks are, was talented as a young person, but found that he could do things like table levitations, and even under conditions unlike many of his contemporaries, where it could be done under full lighting conditions. It didn't require darkness or dim light, but full light in the presence of skeptics, and he did it hundreds of times, all throughout Europe primarily, some in the United States too, in the presence of severe skeptics, royalty, government officials, scientists. No one ever was able to catch him in fraud. And even the one of the things I mentioned in the book was a review about Home by a professional magician, contemporary magician, went back and read all the materials and did an assessment of, from a stage magician perspective, what does he think of this? And he was pretty honest in his response. He said, we have no idea. We don't know what went on here. It doesn't look like it was any magic trick that anybody knew. The best magicians of the day, and I'm talking about stage magicians, who knew how to do these as tricks, things like levitating a large, heavy table, they could not figure out how he did it. Now, that, of course, doesn't necessarily mean that it wasn't a magician's trick, except that the best magicians of the day were completely fooled if it was a trick. And moreover, as I said, after a long career and thousands of these performances, no one ever was able to find anything other than a genuine effect. So one of the reasons why I chose Home is because he fits into a class I call Merlin class magicians, that he's a real person, he did real things, but with the kind of abilities that are attributed to legendary figures like Merlin. Like he's like a fictional character, except he wasn't fictional, he was actually real.
Yeah, I know, and a lot of people like that, actually.
Yeah, except in this case, Home is one of a handful of people in history that we know of that was able to do this. So it's very, very rare. And of course, that makes it more difficult to know what to do with it. When you encounter somebody who is rare, like one in a billion people, well, there are people out there like that. I mean, anytime you meet somebody like an Olympic athlete, they're not a normal person. They're
right.
One in probably not a billion, but one in maybe 100 million. They're rare people, and they're not normal. As
no.
compared to the normal population. Well, there are people like that on this scale, too, who have extremely strong psychic abilities.
Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take another little break here, and I urge you to subscribe to Dreamland and also go to, is it ions.org? Can you spell it out for us, Dean?
Actually, ions.org will work, too. I-O-N-S, or Noetic, N-O-E-T-I-C, .org.
Right. Okay, good. Both of them go to the same place. Because,
yeah.
As I say, there's a lot to do there. It's actually about the very kind of empowerment that we're talking about. So if you've had this stuff in your life, That's a good place to go to start really working with it. Dean's book is called Real Magic for a reason. It is real, and if you've got a little gold, you can end up with a lot of gold. Or if you don't think you've got any, you can explore all of your own possibilities there. We'll be right back. QAnon is getting huge. And it's about conspiracies, many of which don't exist, but there are real conspiracies, and we explore them seriously on unknowncountry.com. Obviously, the alien abduction experience, the UFO cover-up, we've explored the Kennedy assassination, we have explored the terrifying Finder's story about feral children, which was covered up by the CIA for national security reasons. Remember TWA Flight 800? We explored that here because there was something genuinely wrong. So if you want to learn about real conspiracies, Unknown Country is a place to go where actual, true conspiracies are explored. So subscribe today. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the Subscribe Now tab right on the masthead. It only costs $4.95 a month or less if you subscribe for a longer period. It's a great website. Don't, and truly a place of wonder, don't wait another day. We need you, and believe you me, now more than ever, you need unknowncountry.com, Dreamland, the Unseen, New Observations, and all of our other material in your life. We're talking to Dean Radin. His book, Real Magic, one of many extraordinary books that he has written. The website to go to is either ions.org or noetic.org. You can click through to them from the Dreamland page. And this is what we're trying to do here is to explore the real avenues of empowerment, because I have a feeling that, frankly, to be blunt, mankind is going to need some new ways of functioning in the universe. And this direction is the direction to go in. A deep state of permanent samadhi coupled with intention and attention is going to empower us beyond the borders of the material world, so that we can look back and begin to rearrange it in ways that will help us survive. It's a succinct statement about what we need and why I think the show is so important. How do you respond to that?
I completely agree. If you pay too much attention now to climate change, deforestation, rising pandemics, melting of the tundra, all of that, it's pretty depressing. It's even more depressing when you look at the lack of political will for anybody to do anything about it. So something needs to happen. Otherwise, Homo sapiens is heading in the same direction as the other 50% of species on the Earth that have disappeared in the last 5 years. And so that's the direction. So how do we get out of that? Well, we may not. I mean, there probably are lots of other planets around where people got to a certain level of, or whatever the equivalent of people were, that would get to a certain level of technological advancement and were not able to overcome what amounts to their adolescence, the adolescence of the species. So if there was a way to transcend our current state and become Homo superior, not in a eugenics way, but simply taking advantage of what we're actually capable of anyway and not suppressing it, which has happened over the last couple of hundred years. If we can get into a state where collectively, say, where people will get together and pray for peace or meditate on helping the environment. The question that immediately comes up in our scientific age is, well, does that do anything? Does it matter if a bunch of people are intending along the same lines for improving the state of the Earth? Well, as it turns out, this is one of the projects that I've been working on with a number of colleagues around the world for over 20 years. One of the projects is called the Global Consciousness Project, and it's looking at the effect of the movement of mass mind in terms of its attention. And so the hypothesis of this is that if we imagine a slightly different way of thinking about the mind and matter, and in the scientific sense, mind is simply a property that emerges out of matter, that emerges out of the brain in some way. Nobody knows how that could happen, but that's the dogma today in neuroscience. Another view, though, is that maybe mind and matter are like two sides of the same coin. They're both fundamental elements in the universe. We don't want to deny that there's really a physical world out there. It has certain properties. It allows us to make things and so on. But mind seems to be different in character. It's subjective. It's your experience. It has qualities that are not quite physical. In fact, not physical at all. So as philosophers like Spinoza and many others suggested, that maybe mind and matter are really two fundamentals in the world, and they're related to each other in a very deep way. If that is true, then if mind or many minds begin to think along certain lines, would that be reflected then in matter in some way? So the Global Consciousness Project was set up to see what happens if a whole bunch of people, millions of people, are paying attention to something that's being carried on the media, worldwide media, live, like the opening ceremony of the Olympics or some horrible hurricane or something like that, something that would capture everybody's attention. Would that unusual movement of mass mind, all attending to the same thing at the same time, is that reflected in the world in some way? So what we do, what we use as a way of measuring if something physical happens in the world, are electronic devices called random number generators. And these are essentially electronic coin flippers that are made in such a way that it's producing sequences of random bits, zeros and ones. But the devices are also designed to be impervious to environmental influence. They're shielded in such a way, and they're created in circuitry so that things like temperature and electromagnetic fields and voltages and proximity of people and all that don't influence it. So in principle, then, nothing should be able to influence it, and yet it's a physical system. So if the movement of mass mind actually changes the physical world in some way, we can detect it by changes in the sequences of zeros and ones. So this project has been going since 1998. It was based on 500 formal events. These were things like big earthquakes and terrorist attacks and big meditations and so on. 500 events selected over the 23 years of this project was the formal part of the experiment. And each case, like if an earthquake happened, we would look at what was happening in the random number generators about an hour before the earthquake struck to typically 4 or 5 hours afterwards. And this was all defined before the data was looked at. And then we would see, is the zeros and ones that are being pushed out randomly, is it still behaving randomly? Or when we assume that lots of people are paying attention to the news right then, maybe it's not behaving randomly. So after 500 events, and this was evaluated a few years ago and published in a journal, the overall results against chance, a chance outcome, was odds of 3 trillion to 1. So what that means is that the results were not chance. We did see a change in the behavior of these devices that should be random, but in fact they were not random, and they were not random during those events. So the bottom line is, does it matter when a whole bunch of people are attending to the same thing at the same time? Yeah, it matters. It actually changes a property of the physical world. The next question, which we want to do too, we haven't done this yet, is what happens if you add attention and intention? So we've only tested attention at this point, but what if you had a billion people not only attending to the same thing, but intending that the forests are going to be healthier, or that the climate is changing in a beneficial direction, or something like that? Would that have a measurable effect? Well, we don't know yet, but I strongly suspect that the answer is yes, it would. So the beauty of this is we take practices that people do. People get together and praying for all kinds of things all the time, or meditating, and we can put it into an experimental context so that using the tools and techniques of modern science, we can see, does it really make a difference? Well, at least we know that attention does make a difference, and we can probably do the same for intention.
You know, I think what you're talking about is a re-empowerment, a re-enchantment of the human mind, a re-empowerment of the human species.
Yep.
And, you know, I really, it occurs to me that I want to interview Roger Nelson, who just published Connected, The Emergence of Global Consciousness. I'm going to have to get in touch with him. I'm sure you know how to do that. And after the show, please help me do that.
Sure.
We have a situation here where there is a very complex decline taking place on Earth. As the environment is declining, so is the quality of life, and with it, the quality of government around the world. The whole human system is in decline. It's fraying around the edges, and in certain places, it's starting to implode. And there is not a way out of this. There isn't, except this sort of thing. And what's frightening to me is that the situation is getting so dire so rapidly that people will panic and will be unable to address intention because they're too scattered and their emotions are too much in turmoil because of what's happening to them.
How do we?
There has to be a way for a core of people who are practiced in basically practiced in inner peace to reach out to others, not by talking, but to gather together as a core for the human future and to reach out. Does that make sense to you?
Well, there have been legends throughout history of secret cabals that are doing exactly that. The stories, like in Theosophy, that there are the Tibetans that are in caves in the Himalayas who have voluntarily withdrawn from society so they can meditate 23 hours a day on precisely what you're saying, that they're mentally holding together the world. It was going on and still is going on, except that the world seems to be heading in the other direction right now.
Right. So did they all die, or is it not working? And I think that the key thing here is this word "secret." I don't think it should be secret.
Well, maybe at one time that was important, but I agree that maybe 30 monks in a cave in Tibet is good enough for a billion people on Earth, but it's not good enough for almost coming up to 8 billion, in which case, you're right. It needs to come out of the caves and go into society. The danger, though, is that the only organized, or at least one of the primary organized ways of doing this today is through religion. And religion puts its own spin on how to do these kinds of prayers. And while there certainly are groups, there are a lot of people doing meditations as well, which are not necessarily religious. So far, there doesn't seem to be a core that everyone can coalesce around. And if large-scale intention can push the world in various ways, we can already look around the world and see that there are competing intentions. They're pushing in not in the same direction, but in different directions. Well, that may not work out too well, because it would only create more chaos and churn in the physical world, which maybe is what we're seeing. So it's true. I don't have a good solution to any of this, other than to point out that yeah, intentions matter. Attention, it matters. If somebody can figure out a way to pull it together, then I think humanity as a whole has a chance.
And yet doing it is as you say, especially because what would happen if it was public would be that there would be people fighting it with competing intentions. This is an adolescent species. There's no question about it, and it has all of the derangements of adolescence about it.
Right.
And yet, at the same time, we have reached our adolescence at a moment when the planet is filling up, and we're not beyond it yet. So it's a dangerous situation. Well, we have to take our final break. Free Dreamlanders, you will be genuinely empowered if you follow the instructions in these wonderful and important announcements, especially the ones about subscribing to this darn website. Do it now.
In 2015, Whitley Strieber entered a whole new level of contact, and his new book, A New World, tells the powerful and revealing story of what's been happening. Read about contact experiences unlike you have ever heard described before. Learn about the breakthroughs in communication that are developing right now. Experience the wonder of seeing into a mirror universe. The thrill of discovering the close encounter experience in an entirely new way. And learn the secret of how Whitley has built a very real and ongoing relationship with our otherworldly visitors. One Amazon reviewer says, a significant document of human empowerment. Another, one mind-bending, reality-shifting read. Another, outstanding. Get A New World today, available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold, and as an audiobook read by Whitley on audible.com. Support unknowncountry.com and its great mission to make contact happen. Use our vast archive of interviews, meditations, commentaries, news, and Whitley Strieber audiobooks to expand your mind and your understanding of close encounter. Meet others who have similar interests on our active free message board or in our subscriber comments and Wednesday night chats. There is no other site like Unknown Country in or out of this world. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe today.
We're talking to Dean Radin. His latest book, Real Magic, Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science, and a Guide to the Secret Power of the Universe, but many, many other books. You can go to ions.com.org or noetic.org and get more deeply involved. And in fact, if you go to Dean's own website, you get a list of all of his books. It says a sampling, and that's simply deanradin.org, of books I have written or contributed to, and there's a huge list. And Connected, in fact, which we just talked about, is one of them. Supernormal. Science, Yoga, and the Experience, Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities. There's so much here, Dean, and yet we have a limited amount of time, but I read this book some years ago. When was it published, Supernormal?
It came out in April of 2018. Oh no, Supernormal. No, that was 2013.
2013. Yeah, I was thinking it was earlier because Anne and I read it. We both read it, and for some strange reason, you didn't come on Dreamland for it. I don't know why, because it's something that we would have normally jumped at. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to go back to it because of I thought that your brief discussion and touching on yoga as a core empowerment in this whole area of engaging our higher powers was so important. And I know you discussed this extensively in Supernormal. Can you talk a little bit more about that book and what we would find in it? Because I don't have a copy of it in front of me.
Mm-hmm. It has a nice red cover because in 2013, all of the big books were covered in red. So that's what the marketeers decided. Let's make a red cover. So the idea of Supernormal is that was the third book that I wrote. And I wrote it in response to people who were basically asking, well, how do I gain these abilities? And so I first tackled the Eastern esoteric approach. And my latest book, Real Magic, is on the Western esoteric approach. So from an Eastern perspective, just like in the West, consciousness is considered to be the fundamental. Everything emerges out of consciousness. So does it matter, or how does it matter? It matters because if you can achieve certain states in that tradition, samadhi, you can do all kinds of things that you can't do in your ordinary state of mind. And so I use the traditional or classical book of yoga, the Yoga Sutras by Patanjali, was written about 2,000 years ago, and it has one of the four little books as part of the Yoga Sutras. It very clearly lays out how to achieve these special siddhis, which is a Sanskrit word meaning roughly attainment or perfection. It's about psychic powers, some of them quite big, like levitation. So how do you do it? Well, the Eightfold Path of yoga, about first half of the path is learning to get your ego in check and to get your ethics and morals in check, which when you think about this, if you're a huge amount of power, then it's pretty important to make sure that you're going to be able to use that power well. And so you need to have your ego in check. Otherwise, power corrupts. So a lot of the early path of yoga is all about that. And then about the second half of the path of yoga is all about the physical exercises, which are not designed as modern yoga is, which is kind of a spiritualized aerobics, but more to allow your body to remain still for 8 to 12 hours while you meditate, because it's really all about meditation. So meditation gets you into these mental states where you're then able to express these various kinds of powers, even though in the Eastern tradition, that is not the goal. It's a major difference between Eastern and Western traditions. The Eastern tradition, the goal is personal liberation, it's to become enlightened so that you can transcend the limitations of the body. In the Western tradition, it's about gaining power. Gaining magical power.
Yes.
But the approach in both directions is basically the same, and then there's kind of a split that happens at the end on now that you have these abilities, what are you going to do with it? Do you want to be enlightened, or do you want to help change the world?
Well, you have to be – you can't change the world without being enlightened, I don't think. Anne used to say enlightenment is what happens when there is nothing left of us but love. And when you think of it that way, you realize that you're Sisyphus, you're struggling to perpetually push a rock up a hill if you're attempting to change the world through these means, but not from a state of enlightenment, because you cannot have the peace of Samadhi without it, and without that, there's no there for you. You're not you can't be a magician. So it is a journey, and what is it a journey about as a species? Well, It's another way of saying it's what happens when you leave adolescence.
Right.
Start to become mature. Maturity is about acceptance. And we're fighting our planet. We're fighting each other. We're fighting for and against everything. We fight. That's what we do. But beyond that, there is a peace which is filled with laughter and a completely different way of being.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you understand all of this very clearly. I know that. How does this do these states work in terms of doing the science that is necessary to do around this in order to validate it for people and thus empower them?
Do you mean how does science study these?
No. I'm asking another. It's a little bit more subtle question. Would a journey toward samadhi coincide with increasing magical empowerment? Let me put it that way.
Oh yeah. So we did a study one time asking about 1,000 people who meditated, either who just began or were long-term meditators, and asked them about how was their experience changed, just their daily life experience changed as a result of doing the meditative practice. And among the questions that we asked, some of them had to do with experiences that were not called psychic, but would be labeled that if we were to assign a label. Things like synchronicities happening more often, or a feeling of connection from one mind to another, and so on. And we found that 75% of the people who were either beginning or long-term meditators, they all reported that these kinds of things just spontaneously started happening. Well, that's what Patanjali was talking about 2,000 years ago in the Yoga Sutras, and what you hear again and again by people who are beginning to simply do meditation, and it almost doesn't matter what kind of meditation, that there's something about getting deeper in touch with the nature of your own consciousness that begins to reveal the world the way it actually is, rather than being filtered through many, many layers of psychological bias that we all carry with us all the time. So the kind of meditation I do is called Vipassana, which roughly translates into this phrase of to see the world the way it is, the way it actually is. And the way the world actually is far more interconnected and transcending the usual limitations of space and time than what you get in your ordinary everyday state of awareness. It's much more deeply holistic and connected. And the more you begin to dive into those states, the more you begin to perceive the world in that way. And that's why you start getting saturated with synchronicities all the time.
So from this state, you can actually induce synchronicity. Can you determine, in other words, let me expand this and make my question more clear.
Mm-hmm.
If you get into this state and there is something that you need, a question, say, you need answered, will a synchronicity happen because you're in the state, or do you have to intend toward that synchronicity?
Mm-hmm. So a synchronicity is often defined as a spontaneous coincidence that has meaning to it, the key word being spontaneous. Well, spontaneous and making it happen are diametrically opposed to each other, except that in the laboratory, when we do studies of things like telepathy or clairvoyance, we are, in essence, creating a spontaneous event at will. So you can make it happen on demand. You can make a synchronicity occur. It's not so the original definition doesn't quite hold anymore, because you can make something happen which normally is spontaneous. So yeah, you can, through the right state of awareness and intention, make things happen which, from a probabilistic perspective, would be quite unlikely to occur all by itself.
Well, that is the way I do research, so I agree with you completely. I learned after Anne died and returned and became my teacher in a whole new way, I've learned this technique, and it, for a writer, you couldn't find a better research technique, boy. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you that. Okay, Dean, can you, before we end our first hour, can you describe your meditation practice a little bit more clearly? Your personal practice, I mean, if you will.
Yeah. So Vipassana is, and its modern incarnation is mindfulness. So mindfulness is like everywhere now. I mean, you can get your mindfulness training through your hospital if you want. It's a very popular technique that has become completely secular and stripped out any kind of possible religious connotations to it. And ultimately, at least in the initial stages, it's about paying attention to your breathing. That's it. And your mind will wander, and then you bring your attention back to your breathing. You just keep doing it again and again until your mind wandering begins to settle down. And eventually you get to the point where your mind doesn't wander for quite a long time, and it becomes empty. And so words like emptiness and stillness are part of the goal. You get into a very empty mental state that feels very, very still. And if you can sustain that long enough, it also starts to feel very good. In many traditions, they talk about a blissful state. Well, you something about this state of stillness begins to feel blissful. And it's, you know, it's not blissful like eating a donut. It's some other kind of bliss, some sort of mental state that simply feels very, very pleasant. So when I've been doing meditation on and off for 40 years, I will do it religiously for a while, and like 6 months or a year, and then I'll stop for a while, and then I'll get back to it. Well, I'm currently in a state where I'm doing it every day, twice a day, and I know that it works because I also keep track of my blood pressure. And when I'm doing a regular practice of meditation, my blood pressure will go right to normal and stay there.
Yeah, mine too. My blood pressure is 110 over 70, and I'm 75 years old. So,
yeah,
you know,
it's all about getting the body to remember this extremely relaxed state.
Exactly, to live in that. Once you feel that whatever meditation practice you use, your body likes that and stays there. Because it's the right place to be. Dean,
it settles down.
We have reached the end of our first hour. And Free Dreamlanders, you are leaving us now. And it's always too bad because there's more to come. But this is your choice. And can you now make another choice, which is to open yourself up to all of the possibilities that were represented by this radio program and by our podcast now, I guess, and by unknowncountry.com. Dean Radin's many books are all in different ways empowering. You can see them all lined up at deanradin.com, I believe it is. And then you can go on your own path of empowerment with the Institute of Noetic Scientists at noetic.org or ions.org. And I urge you to do this now. Get going. The world needs you. And I say that from the bottom of my heart. It really does now. This is no joke, and it's not a commercial. It's just the raw truth. Subscribers, we're going to keep right on keeping on. We're going deeper down some very interesting paths, I can assure you.